On the Job with Fred Sleet and Sally Rugg.
On the Job, the podcast all about making your working life better. I'm Francis Leach.
I'm Sally Rugg, and anything I say in the podcast doesn't necessarily represent the views of my employer.
Anything I say is a consequence of still being drunk after New Year's Eve. Hello, Sally. Happy 2021.
Thank you so much. It feels good. It's a good new year.
Did you get your resolutions? Did you get them done?
Yeah, I did. But the ones this year, my resolutions this year are a little more airy-fairy. In the past, I've had things like learn to drive. I mean, that was a while ago now, but, you know, some really solid builder website. Whereas the ones this year are like, be more healthy. Like, I need to work on my health a little bit. Just sort of,
That's an achievable one, though.
Well, I hope so, yeah. And, like, spend less money on things like eyelashes.
They're looking great, by the way.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it.
Certainly worth the $150. Hey, let's jump straight into this week's guest. Doug Cameron was a Labor senator. He's also been a long-time unionist and an advocate for working people. He's known for his very straight-talking Sally, his thick Scottish brogue, and his take-no-prisoners approach.
I don't want to objectify the good former senator, but I honestly, like, I could listen to Doug Cameron read the phone book. I really like that Scottish accent.
Should we ask him to do that at the end of this interview for you?
Yeah, maybe a bedtime story.
Doug, welcome to On the Job. How are you doing?
I'm good, Francis. Hi, Sally. How are you going?
Very well, thank you.
I'm really good to have Doug on the program. It's fantastic. Now, firstly, Doug, how are you enjoying retirement? You don't seem the retiring type to me. What are you doing with yourself?
Well, I've Elaine and I moved to Tasmania.
Wow.
And we are climate change refugees.
What does that involve? Have you sort of built a house on stilts at the top of a hill or something?
No, nothing like that. We just love Tassie. We're in Hobart, so we've got a really nice place with fantastic views across the Derwent over to Cunyani. So we are doing it pretty well down here.
Sounds lovely, Doug. Now, before we get stuck into the interview, the great tradition on this podcast is to ask our esteemed guests two questions. First job and worst ever job. What was your first job, Doug?
My first job was a paper boy in Scotland delivering the morning papers.
That's the same as Francis's first job.
I think his gig might have been a bit tougher than mine because he would have been riding around Glaswegian streets in the freezing cold dead of winter, throwing the Scotsman at people.
My worst memory of that job was when we used to have a little wheelbarrow with all the papers in it and you'd just go for miles delivering the papers. And you know what Scottish winters are like? There was a new building site with foundations and we had these boots with steel tacks in the bottom. So we used to slide on the ice and I got onto this ice with my newspaper gear. So I slid on the ice and it gave way. I ended up to my belly button with cold, icy water. And when I got out, my jeans froze.
Oh,
so I was red raw by the time I'd finished my round. So I don't want to deliver any more papers, I can tell you.
You finished the round. That is commitment.
You had to finish the round or you wouldn't be paid. There was no union for paper boys in those days. They needed a union.
Was that also your worst job then too?
I've been pretty lucky. I've had some good jobs, and the luck I had, it wasn't so much luck. It was planning by workers over the years. Most of the jobs I had were union sites with good conditions, good people on the job, prepared to help you. And, it was a great comradeship then. So if you want a good job and you were a blue-collar worker in my day, you got a union job.
That's a very diplomatic answer of you, Doug. Doug, you can tell you're a former senator there.
Can we talk a little bit about your, you know, your politicisation, Doug, as a young guy working in Glasgow or working in Scotland, and how you became so passionately involved with unions and what that did to change your life and you know, I guess your journey to Australia?
Well, I grew up in a town outside Glasgow called Beltill, a working-class town, coal mining, steelworks, engineering works, and a great tradition of unionism. And it was just natural when I joined the job, when I got my first job, the shop steward came up and I signed up as an apprentice. So I've been a union member from the day I put my foot into a full-time job, and I've been very lucky. And so the culture in Scotland was collectivism. The culture was to stand up for yourself, and the culture was to stand up collectively.
And that's something that you've managed to transmit to your political career here in Australia. But when you arrived in Australia, was there that same, I guess, political culture and working class consciousness, or was it different?
Look, it was different, but there was still, you know, a terrific, the workshops I went to, my one of my first jobs was at GM in Pagewood, in Sydney, a unionised shop. The boss said to me, oh, there's two unions you can join. You can join the union that will remain nameless or my union, the AEU. And I decided, and he recommended not the AEU at the time, but the other union. So I decided very quickly that I should join the union that he didn't recommend. And I joined the Metal Workers Union.
And things at that time, you were in a pretty much a unionised shop, but it's changed so dramatically. What have been the key elements that have, in a sense, undermined that, you know, that coverage that unions used to have in those workplaces where it was, you know, nearly everybody would be a union member, wouldn't they?
Yeah, it was, you know, highly unionised. I think the biggest change has been the industrial legislation. The industrial legislation restricts right of entry for union officials. It restricts what you can bargain about and what you can bargain for. And I remember when I was came to Sydney as a union official in the early 1980s, you could go to mass meetings at Redfern Oval. You could go to, you know, Leichhardt Oval in Western Sydney, and there would be tens of thousands of workers from the manufacturing sector, you know, coming together to discuss collective issues, to discuss how we could make things better. And we gained, you know, so even if you were in a weak shop and you went to one of those meetings, you knew you were part of a strong union movement. But enterprise bargaining has, in my view, meant that workers are only concerned about their individual workshop. There's none of that. You know, I describe it as looking down at your toes while you're walking. You never look up and look around and see what's happening elsewhere. So I think that enterprise bargaining has done that. Successive governments, both Labour and Liberal, have made it tougher for bargaining, made it tougher for union officials to enter. And with the introduction of the ABCC, the Registered Organisations Commission, the Fair Work Ombudsman, what a nonsensical name for that mob, who simply go out and, you know, say to bosses, well, we've found you've been acting illegally, but just give an undertaking and everything will be okay. So that's weakened the union movement. There's no doubt about that in my mind.
Just to pick you up, you said, but you know, successive Liberal and Labor governments, you feel, have sort of contributed to the state of affairs at the moment. And you were recently fairly vocal around what you describe as neoliberal third way policies from the right faction of the Labor Party, you know, warning that the Labor Party mustn't become a pale imitation of the Liberals. Can you talk us through what you're meaning by those policies and how do you think that's impacted?
That was my polite description. That was my public description of it.
Well, let rip right now.
Look, I just think it was a capitulation to neoliberalism. I think it was panic by some in the right in the Labour Party. I mean, we get people, you know, going out and say, oh, we should all be nice to each other in Parliament, you know? Well, how can I be nice to someone who's trying to destroy the lives of working people? Why should I be nice to someone that wants to give tax cuts to the rich in the country and take social security payments away from the poorest workers? How can I be nice to someone that supports work choices? It's just not in me to do that. Try to push yourself to the right-wing Murdoch media instead of actually believing in something and doing something on behalf of working people. This whole argument about from the right that Labour has abandoned its working base or is not relevant to blue-collar workers, I think is an absolute nonsense. If you look at the policies that the predominant right in the Labour Party have put in place, free trade, restrictions on union rights, pushing down on unemployed workers, restructuring, they've got a lot to answer for. And I find it quite laughable that they are now the ones that helped bring about the situation the Labour Party's in, are now the ones that are saying, oh, we've got to get back to our base when they've been destroying the base.
So what do you see the way forward? What do you think the Labour Party should be doing to counter the impacts of those approaches you've just described?
Well, first of all, I think the unions should be ensuring that people they support to go into the Parliament, either in the Senate or at the local level, support progressive policies, support a future for young people in this country by dealing with climate change, ensuring that the balance of power between working people and business is properly balanced, ensuring that that the unions can be what has been described as a countervailing power to the power of business. That's where we should be going, making sure that workers have got rights and workers have got a strong voice. And if without a union movement, we don't have that.
Doug, I can still feel the energy and passion when you speak. So you're invested in these issues very heavily, always have been. I just wonder, when you were in Parliament and you had to sort of work with a whole range of different people across the political spectrum, how you managed that? Were you ever able to make a connection across the aisle with someone from a different party? And did you have anyone or were particular people in particular who just got on your goat, that oil and water, it just was never going to mix?
We want names.
We want names.
We want gossip.
Did you ever go full Malcolm Tucker on someone and just give them a mouthful of your finest working class Scots?
I have done that.
Really? I would never have guessed.
But there was one person I got on with personally. Didn't like the politics, but got on personally with them, and that was a guy they call Wacker Williams, John Williams. The reason I got on okay with him was that he really was an agrarian socialist.
He just didn't realise it.
But he did have, through personal experience, been done over by the banks, and he had set himself out to square off while he was a senator, and I admired that in him. A lot of his other stuff was pure rubbish, but he had that, so I got on okay with him, I had big differences with many people in the Labour Party. I didn't want to go down to Parliament and just follow whatever the leader said. There has to be constructive criticism. There has to be voices against neoliberalism. And there are so many issues that I found in Parliament that we could do better. I just hated this view that we should simply give more and more power to the security services without, decent checks and balances. And I hated this thing that, oh, we've got a strong parliamentary oversight on security services in this country. We don't. We've got some of the weakest in the Western world. And you hear that, the committee that oversights is a powerful committee. It's one of the weakest in the Western world. So I had arguments about that. I opposed the free trade agreements, because it was just neoliberalism writ large. It was the destruction of the manufacturing sector. So I had big disagreements on those things, and I had disagreements with every leader I served under.
People who I have worked with over the years will sort of enthusiastically affirm that I have a similar approach to work, Doug. I often disagree with the people I work with, but I think that is the sign of a good worker, like someone who actually brings their expertise, brings their passion. And I think the Australian public deserve to have their representatives go down to Canberra or, you know, whichever parliament they're going to, and bring their full expertise, experience and advocacy, and not just sort of toe the party line. I think it's great.
Look, I agree with that, but, you know, there is at times a need for some discipline. I did most of my opposition within the caucus. Sometimes I was a lone voice in the caucus, and I could never understand that, because the unions have been so influential in putting people in there, but their voices were never heard. And I think it's a lesson for the union movement that you need to put people in there that have got a bit of passion. You need to make sure that you only support people that are going to look after working people, and don't run around trying to be nice to the murder press because they think they'll get a good headline in The Australian. I just don't get that.
Can I just ask you about that then? What happens to people who probably go to Parliament with those aspirations that you just outlined, yet when they get there, their voices are muted? They somehow retreat from the principles that have driven them to a position of prominence within the Parliament. What happens?
I think a lot of it is people want to climb up the greasy pole, so they'll abandon their position for, you know, a collective position for their own self-advancement. I think that's clear.
I just want to ask you about the Murdoch press, because there's obviously been a huge discussion this year, and indeed every year, particularly with Kevin Rudd's petition and Malcolm Turnbull, I don't know, like suddenly deciding that he had an opinion on this sort of thing and speaking out. You know, there's been a big discussion about the toxicity or the impact, the influence of the Murdoch empire. And you made a comment just now about people in the Labor Party being overly worried about getting a bad headline from News Corp. And I wondered if you could talk me through that strategy, because I think there is sometimes a little bit of, like, I can see merit on both sides, right? Like, I can see merit in sticking it to the Murdoch empire, but I also can see merit in sort of like, you don't want to become the target of an intensely vicious, well-funded, well-coordinated attack. And so how do you see the balance shaking out there?
Well, Sally, I think in the context of the murder press attacking you individual, I think it's a sign of weakness if you capitulate to that. If it's being tactical and trying to make sure that the party is not attacked needlessly, that's a different thing. And we've tried that, and it doesn't work. No matter what Labour does, they will embrace you if it suits their position, and they will dump you just as quickly. So I think people need to be absolutely committed to their points of view, regardless of whether you get attacked by the Murdoch press. The problem is they are not many working people read The Australian, right?
Well, not many people read
Full
The Australian at all.
Yeah, that's right. So especially working people. So the Murdoch press seem to set the news agenda. And this is, you know, now the ABC seems to be getting caught up in this. You know, they've got the News Limited reporters on all the opinion makers shows, like The Insiders. And, you know, you see them on the drum, you know. And it's all supposed to be this balance. But surely Rupert Murdoch doesn't need the ABC to give him balance. You know, I just don't get it. Mm.
Doug, can I ask you about the upcoming political cycle? So there could possibly be an election in July this year. Some people are thinking that this government's not going to go full term. Is Anthony Albanese in a position to win an election? There seems to be a growing sense of pessimism around progressive politics that that's not going to happen this time, or is it too early to tell?
It's far too early to tell. I just don't think we've been in anything like a normal political cycle. You know, and the example of that is how crass, how, you know, stupid, how uncaring the Prime Minister was during the bushfires. You know, just to head off overseas in the middle of, you know, a national disaster, come back and behave like a buffoon, you know, shows you that this guy just doesn't get it. But the coronavirus has given him an opportunity to shapeshift. And that's what he's done. He's shifting his shape. But I think, you know, a lot of people understand that this is not the real Morrison. But there had to be that sort of, you know, everybody getting behind stopping the virus. So that has not been a normal period of time. And when people tell me someone can't win, who would have ever thought John Howard would win an election? Who would have ever thought he had the charisma, the leadership to win an election? But he did, you know, and Ronald Reagan in the US. So if Reagan can become a president, John Howard can become a prime minister, certainly Labour can take a leader, a good leader like Anthony Albanese, and be and win an election.
Just to finish for both of you, you both worked very hard on the marriage equality issue, and Doug, you were out very early and very strongly in support of changes to the law. Is that one of your biggest achievements as a senator and a parliamentarian, being part of that campaign?
Well, look, it's an important campaign. I don't think I would take any, you know, great sense of ownership or achievement. I just did what I thought was right. And I was sick of Labour politicians who were, you know, clearly gay, lesbian, and having to get up and support that marriage was between a man and a woman. I just thought that was bizarre. And I just couldn't accept that. And I think I was one of the first blue-collar, you know, ex-union leaders to come out and say, this has got to change. I attended rallies in Sydney. I did interviews with the gay press. And I just argued that this was the right for them to be treated the same as everybody else. They were no different to anyone else. They should have the same rights as any Australian citizen. It just offended me that, you know, some people were running that line and they should never have done it.
I think the way you described your own participation there, you know, I can't feel any ownership over the outcome and I only did a little bit. I think that is the beauty of what was the marriage equality campaign, was that it actually wasn't sort of a handful of people like me who you might have seen on television once or twice. You know, it was never a handful of people. It was tens of thousands that grew to millions of ordinary people just doing that little bit, but doing it all together. And I think the achievement of marriage equality in Australia was such an incredible moment of collective action across, you know, all walks of life, everybody just doing a little bit.
And it shows that when we do and we act collectively, we can change stuff, Doug. And that's still something you obviously passionately believe in. Can I ask, what is a Doug Cameron Christmas like and a new year? How have you spent your time? And what's 2021 got in store for you?
My wife just had a major ankle reconstruction and I'm doing the domestic duties at home.
Like you always do, right?
I'll tell you what.
This isn't a new thing for you, Doug. I need you to assure us of that.
I get brought up in the days where, you know, the blokes didn't do a lot, and I had jobs where Elaine kept the family together and did everything in the family. And now that she's incapacitated and can't get on a plane, I'm doing lots of stuff I've never done before. I think I'm up to my Cert 3 in domestic duties.
Well, I'm sad to hear about Elaine's ankle, but I'm happy to hear that you're stepping up with the domestic labour, Doug.
I am. I've got dishwasher's hands now. So. And the new year, just settling down. Hopefully, we can get around a bit more than we have since we've come down here. But we've been very lucky.
Yep.
And here it's been very good. And compared to what many working class people have gone through, we have been so lucky to be where we are. And I just don't get it that we're now talking about cutting back government support when the market is still in chaos. And this will be a big problem. And every progressive person in the country, in my view, will need to be fighting against these cutbacks, this work choices too, all of that stuff. There's plenty for progressive people to do.
A lot of work to be done, Doug. Thank you so much for talking to us. Onwards and upwards in 2021. And thanks for being on the job.
No worries. And thanks for inviting me.
Doug Cameron there, former senator, all-round good guy, and now dish pig.
I am pleased to hear that he's pulling his weight a little bit around the house in his retirement years, finally learning how to do the housework.
Got a lot of catching up to do.
He does. And I'm really glad to hear for his wife's sake that he's doing that.
Enjoy the rest of the first week of 2021. Let's hope it's the start of a better year.
I hope so. It feels like it already. And just with a bit of positive attitude, can-do spirit. Nah, we know that's not what counts. But it's certainly how I'm feeling at the moment. So, all the best for your new year too, Francis. And let's chat again next week.
Let's do that. Don't forget, you can subscribe to our podcast on your favourite podcasting platform. And don't forget to give us a review. We'd like 5 stars if you can give it.
Give us a review in a podcast app, or like even just take it public. You could post on your Facebook, in your group chat. Why not post a review to like iTunes and then copy and paste it to your Twitter feed? I mean, what a great idea.
More people can find us and we can all enjoy it together. We'll catch you next week on the job. On the job.